Gideon and Jimbo stayed to the back roads and took roundings on the town, for the new owners of the Hayworth lands might be searching for them. A mile past town, they were overtaken by a gray-haired old black man carrying two turning plows in a wagon.
You boys want a ride?
Well, thank you.
Thank you kindly.
They rode together in silence until the sun reached midpoint.
Dinner time. Ain't got much in the way of victuals, but you boys is welcome to share what there is.
He had spoken truthfully. He had part of a loaf of bread and a small piece of cold ham hock. In a jug, he had what Gideon assumed to be water until he uncorked it and found it to be corn whiskey of the rankest kind.
Yeah!
Jimbo found no fault in it. Gideon unwrapped what little food they had brought from the plantation and added it to the bit the old man had put before them.
Well, the Lord will not smite us for our gluttony.
When the old man reached the gate where he was to turn in, he reined up.
Well, this is as far as I go. It seems to me you boys might find some work for my master. Why not come on with me and ask?
Many of the older people had never gotten over the use of the word master, but Gideon feared they were too near the Hayworth place. Jimbo liked to talk. Sooner or later, he was bound to tell what they had done. That kind of story would spread, for the black people would glory in it. Inevitably, it would spread beyond black ears to white.
We thank you kindly, Uncle, but we expect we'll just keep on traveling for a while.
Bad memories twisted the farmer's wrinkles into a frown.
If I was a younger man, I'd like as not just leave this old wagon sitting here and go with you boys. I taken me a notion to travel once, like you're doing. Only them days, it wasn't allowed. Went a long ways before the slave catchers got me. Taking 2 months for my back to heal to where I could even lay on it overnight. Yeah, you boys ain't been away from home before, so you don't know what to expect. I'll just tell you one thing. Don't be ashamed to take a kindness anywhere it's offered to you. You won't see many. Get up!
The two young men watched the wagon disappear behind a stand of young corn. Gideon could read Jimbo's thoughts. One word of encouragement would send Jimbo running after it.
I feel rested. We better be using them.
They walked all afternoon, passing through farming country that looked much the same as the place where Gideon had spent his life. But it was not the same. The people were different. The men and women hoeing the fields were strangers to him, and he had never been at ease among strangers. Melancholy settled over him as it got toward sundown. He teetered dangerously along the edge of a fear that he sensed could turn into panic if he loosened his grip. He leaned defensively toward the whistling Jimbo, who kept picking up a rock and sailing it down the road. When he reached the spot where it had landed, he would pick it up and sail it again.
Been a long time since we ate.
Gideon could not muster the nerve to walk up to white folks' houses and ask for food. Just before dark, he saw a black woman standing in front of a mean box shanty, calling to her children.
Y'all children, come in here!
There, Gideon thought they might find kindred souls. As they walked toward the shanty, he saw no kindness in her face. She retreated beyond the door, ready to slam it in an instant. The dancing flicker of a lighted pine knot made her shadow bob and weave on the smoothly swept ground in front of the cabin. Gideon took off his soft hat and bowed the way he'd been taught from boyhood to approach his betters.
Evening, lady.
She moved 1 foot distrustfully farther back inside the house, her hand on the edge of the door.
What y'all want here?
We're looking for work, and we run fresh out of anything to eat. We was wondering if after you fed your youngins, you might have a little something left over?
You got money to pay?
All Gideon had was his $5 gold piece, the one those carpetbaggers hadn't seen him drop on the ground. Jimbo didn't even have that.
No, ma'am. But we'd be proud to do some work to pay for what you give us.
We can't hardly even feed our own. And you tramps come in on us every blessed day to beg or steal even the little bit we got. Get now! Do you hear me? Get!
We ain't no tramps. We're hunting for work.
Everybody's hunting work.
A man appeared behind the woman and moved her out of the way. He was so large that he blocked off most of the light from the pine knot.
My woman spoke out plain. She told you to get.
So get, or I'll get you.
Chilled, Gideon backed off. Then they turned and walked to the road again. A little further along, they rolled their blankets in the grass and lay down hungry. Gideon didn't sleep much. In his mind, he kept reliving the harsh day just past and fearing what lay ahead. At dawn, he threw back his blanket. He saw Jimbo lying awake, looking at him.
You as hungry as I am?
I expect so.
I've been hearing a rooster crow over yonder. Where there's a rooster, there's chickens.
You studying on going and stealing?
Not stealing, just borrowing. We ever come this way again, we'll pay him back.
I don't want to do no stealing.
Then you just wait right here. I won't be gone long.
Jimbo laid his blanket aside, climbed over a sagging rail fence, and stooped low, disappearing into the undergrowth that surrounded a small field. In a little while, he returned, carrying his hat in his hands. He motioned for Gideon to take it before he climbed the fence again. The hat held almost a dozen eggs.
I didn't hear no commotion.
I've been borrowing eggs off old Colonel for many a year. We better get on down the road a piece before we do any cooking.
Gideon hoped for much, but expected little. He was not surprised. The day brought them nothing but rejections. It was a while before Gideon began to suspect that the swollen whip mark on Jimbo's face was an extra liability when they already had more than enough. They had come to a cotton field where a dozen black men hoed weeds under the silent supervision of a white farmer. Hats in their hands, the two walked hopefully across the soft earth between the rows, carefully watching a mean-looking black dog that sat nearby.
Hush!
Begging your pardon, sir, but we're looking for work.
The farmer eyed them critically, especially Jimbo.
Where you boys come from?
We worked all our lives for old Colonel Hayworth.
The farmer seemed to know the name, but he frowned in suspicion.
If you quit him, he'd probably quit me, too, about the time I needed you most.
Oh, no, sir. We didn't quit. Colonel Hayworth, he lost the place for time.
Gideon tried to explain, but the farmer didn't seem to be paying them much mind. He was staring at Jimbo.
Where'd you get that mark, boy? You been fighting? Last thing I need around here is a fighting nigger.
No, sir. He's no fighter. The new owner of Colonel Hayworth's
plantation... If it is a whip mark, then I expect you done something to deserve the whipping. No use me adding to the grief I already got. You boys get yourselves on down the road.
Oh, it's not the way you think, sir. We're both good hard workers. If you let us show you...
Satan, sick him.
Gideon and Jimbo ran all the way down the road, slapping their hats at the black dog, snarling and biting at their heels.
Hey, Dad, come!
They kept trotting until they were well away. Stopping for breath, Gideon found that the sharp teeth had ripped a hole in the lower left leg of his trousers. A thin seam of blood showed why he felt a burning. It struck Jimbo funny.
At first 100 yards, Gid, I believe you'd have taken a lead on old Colonel's good saw pacer.
Gideon failed to see the humor. Sometimes Jimbo's cheerfulness was the balm of Gilead. Other times, it was salt on a raw sore. They tried a few more farms that day. They weren't chased by any more dogs, but they weren't hired to work either. One ragged white farmer, a little better off than most of the black laborers, took pity enough to give them the leftovers from his family's supper. But he must have had a flock of hungry young'uns, because the leavings were meager and plain. Along about dark, Gideon and Jimbo found an abandoned cabin from which all the windows had been removed and much of the roof was gone. Though they could see stars through the wide gaps in the shingles, and the rotten wood floor was even harder than the ground, it seemed somehow more civilized and fitting to sleep here than out on the open road. They set out walking with no breakfast except a long drink of water from the old cistern. About mid-afternoon, they came alongside an open pasture from which most of the timber had been cut years before, letting sunshine in upon the succulent grass. Scattered across the pasture were many thoroughbred mares, most of them trailing colts. Jimbo's tired shoulders straightened.
Gid, I wished you'd looky there.
A couple of colts, one a brown and the other a chestnut sorrel, trotted up to the rail fence in ear-pointing curiosity. When Jimbo spoke, the colts hoisted their tails and loped away. They stopped 30 yards into the pasture and turned, taking another look at the travelers. They ran again, moving well past the two men and then cutting back to the fence. There they stopped and playfully poked their heads over the top rail like children. Gideon had always been able to take horses or leave them alone, He could ride with modest competence, but had never shared Jimbo's eagerness or natural affinity. Old Colonel had always bragged that Jimbo rode like an Indian. Gideon didn't know. He'd never seen an Indian. Jimbo had forgotten about weariness. He was walking rapidly, almost in a trot, beckoning for Gideon to hurry.
This is the place, Gid. I'll work here if they don't even pay me for it.
Jimbo didn't wait to reach the gate. He climbed over the fence and cut across to the road. Gideon had to trot to keep pace with him. As they approached the barns, he saw rising dust and heard shouts and running horses. He observed a carriage with a pair of brown horses hitched to it. Saddled horses were tied to a fence. He blinked in surprise at the sight of a blue-uniformed soldier slouching against the carriage, half asleep. That soldier was black. Gideon's mouth dropped open. He had heard about black Yankee soldiers, but he had never seen one. Old Colonel had called him an abomination. Gideon wasn't sure what the term meant, but he assumed it was bad because Hayworth used it like a cuss word. Jimbo had never let caution restrain him when he wanted something.
Hey, soldier, how's a dark-complected gentleman get one of them pretty suits?
The soldier tensed.
You stay back away from the captain's carriage.
Jimbo cocked his head toward the commotion on the other side of the barns.
What they doing back yonder?
It's army business, and ain't none of yours.
I hear horses running. I believe I'll just go look.
It never occurred to Jimbo that the soldier might try to stop him, and if it occurred to the soldier, the notion quickly died. Both Jimbo and Gideon were taller and broader in the shoulders.
I told you, they horsewhip you. Don't come blaming me.
Gideon followed the fast-walking Jimbo around the barn toward the racket. Climbing up on a plank fence, he saw several horses running excitedly back and forth in a pen. In the center, two uniformed black soldiers and a couple of black farmhands had a young bay horse at the end of a rope and were trying to girth up a small military saddle, while the horse shied and kicked in fright. The blue uniforms were sadly grayed by dust. Near the barn stood a tall white man in a uniform and a middle-aged chunky man in the worn clothing of a planter, chewing worriedly on an unlighted cigar. When the saddle was secure, the farmhands held the nervous horse while the soldier cautiously stuck his left foot into the steel stirrup and tried to swing aboard. The horse fought and pawed. The soldier managed to take a seat, and the other men stepped out of the way. Bawling in frightened displeasure, the horse dropped his head and crow-hopped around the pen. The soldier bounced, the daylight widening between rump and saddle. In a moment, he sailed to earth in an undignified scramble of arms and legs. The officer glanced up at him, then motioned to another soldier.
You try him, Roberson.
The planter bit down on his cigar. Gideon assumed that the man was trying to sell these young horses to the army officer, and that the show out there was not helping his chances. The bay made even shorter work of the second soldier. Jimbo slapped his hand against his knee. The officer glanced again at Jimbo, resentment in his sharp eyes.
That one of your boys, Mr. Cooper?
No. I thought they was with you.
He cut his eyes to Jimbo.
You boy, what you doing here? You get down off of that fence and away from here before I take a whip to you.
Didn't go to cause offense, sir. Me and Gid, we just come here to see if we might get us a job helping you with your horses, sir.
I already got more help than I need. A lot more. Get along.
I was the boss horse handler for old Colonel Hayworth, sir.
You don't look like any horseman to me.
The planter took a couple of long strides toward the fence, his face darkening.
I told you...
Just a minute, Mr. Cooper.
He studied Jimbo critically as he approached.
You laughed at those boys of mine. You think you could do any better?
Jimbo smiled.
Sir, them boys don't know how to talk to that horse.
And you do?
I believe so, sir.
Talk is cheap. Get out there and show us.
Jimbo climbed down into the pen. He flashed Gideon a look of total confidence and walked to where Cooper's men held the fidgeting, pawing bay. He touched his hand to the reins.
Y'all just back off a ways. Let me have him.
He'll bust you like an egg.
Me and him's fixing to be friends. Hey there.
Gideon couldn't hear the words, and he knew they didn't matter. It was his tone that counted. Jimbo was talking and suddenly reaching out, letting the pony get a good look at him and his black hand before he took another step. The bay trembled and started to paw at the ground in front of him. Jimbo stood his ground, and somehow seemed to talk the horse out of it. In a minute, he had his hand on the dark neck and was rubbing from cheek to throat and down to foreshoulder, talking all the while. He rubbed and patted and cajoled, and the horse seemed to calm. Jimbo brought the reins up carefully, passed them over the suspicious ears, rubbed again, first the neck and then the shoulder. He raised his left foot slowly and deliberately until he fitted it into the stirrup. He let the horse feel his weight tentatively while he leaned against him, still patting. When he swung into the saddle, the horse was startled only momentarily. It stood trembling, back slightly humped.
Easy now. That wasn't much anything, now was it? Settle down now.
Jimbo leaned forward a little, letting the horse know the feel of his gentle hand along the neck, letting it hear the soft and reassuring tone of his voice. He put the horse into a walk, then into a trot. Its back was still arched, and the steps were uncertain and threatening, but the horse did not pitch. Around and around Jimbo rode. The horse gradually let down its back. Its steps took on confidence. Much of the fear and all of the threat disappeared. Jimbo rode him directly up to the officer.
There he is, sir. Ain't no mean in this horse.
The officer stared in silence. The planter, Cooper, was smiling around his unlighted cigar.
Boy, I believe you said something about looking for a job.
Me and Gid yonder, we come together.
What's your name, boy?
Jimbo.
Just Jimbo? Nothing else?
Jimbo's all they ever told me, sir.
Jimbo, can you do that with all horses?
Some takes longer than others, but yes, sir. Horses and me have always got along pretty good.
Oh, Mr. Cooper here seems on the point of offering you a job, but I might be able to offer you a better one. You ever think about being a soldier?
That question was a surprise for both Jimbo and Gideon.
No, sir. Such a thing never entered my thinking.
I'm stationed in New Orleans. Besides buying remounts, I am also charged with the responsibility of helping recruit good men for 2 regiments of colored cavalry. Would you be interested?
Jimbo stepped cautiously down from the saddle and patted the bay on the neck.
You mean you want me to be a Yankee soldier?
Not Yankee. That's all over and done with. Just American. We're all Americans again. The life is interesting, the food is regular, and private soldiers paid $13 a month.
Jimbo looked at Gideon.
$13?
That was more than anybody would pay for farm labor.
Would I have me one of them pretty blue suits?
Everybody wears a uniform.
And I'd get to ride horses every day?
I believe I can promise you that. You would be given some basic training in New Orleans, then be sent west as a replacement for one of the colored cavalry regiments.
West?
To Gideon, the word had an ominous feel, a sense of strangeness, conjuring up visions of a distant and vaguely frightening land of wild animals and wild men. He had heard talk. Since the war, many of the white folks had drifted west looking for a place to piece broken lives back together. Most had never been seen again. The officer seemed to sense Gideon's foreboding.
You'll like the West. It's a new land, fresh and unspoiled, big and open and fine. A land of opportunity for everybody. How much opportunity will you ever find here? You're a slave here, almost one. But out West, black or white, every man is a man.
Gideon looked at the ground.
Might be awfully easy out there to be a dead man.
Ah, wild exaggerations. More men are killed in knife fights in New Orleans in a month than are killed out west in a year. And here, there's yellow fever. Do you know how many people die here when yellow fever sweeps this country?
Gideon had a fair notion. His mother had died of it.
Yellow fever is unknown out west. It's the healthiest place in the world for a young and active man. Fresh air, sunshine, 3 solid meals every day. And think of the money. $13 a month. If you're frugal, you can save just about all of that. In a few years, you'll have enough to buy a farm or set yourself up in a good business anywhere you want to.
Gideon was tempted, but doubts remained. The officer saw that Jimbo was already convinced.
Jimbo, as long as you're joining the army anyway, I'd like to have you try out the rest of the horses Mr. Cooper wants to sell us.
Cooper had listened sullenly, knowing he was being euchred out of a potential horse handler. But the pain was allayed by the improved probability of selling the army these horses and getting his hands on some good solid Union silver. Gideon knew how the conversation would end. He could tell by Jimbo's eagerness in doing the captain's bidding. But he had a nagging suspicion that the captain had not fully answered his questions.
Sir, what about the Indians?
The officer smiled.
Young fella, I've known men who've spent years in the West and have never seen an Indian.
At last.
Gray Horse Running was so intent upon the deer that he almost missed seeing the soldiers until it was too late. He dropped upon his belly, his heart pounding in surprise. He raised his head slowly to peer above the heavy growth of seeded-out grass stems and to wonder at the first soldiers he had ever seen. Their faces were black, all but one. White men with black skins. He had heard of such things, but had been skeptical. He took a rough count of the soldiers. They were about as many as the fingers on both of his hands twice over. Some did not ride particularly well. They bounced in the small saddles and appeared very uncomfortable. He lay still, trying to keep a grip on himself when it seemed they were going to ride directly over him. Gray Horse was on the homeward leg of his first genuine raiding trip. After coming down from the mountain, he had tried to convince the warriors that he had indeed found his medicine. His cousin, Bear that Turns to Fight, doubted it and said so. Bear had held a grudge against him since a day years ago when Gray Horse had beaten him badly in a horse race. More or less on probation, Gray Horse had been permitted to go on a couple of long cattle drives, but it had been left to experienced raiders actually to take the Tejano cattle. Gray Horse had been obliged to wait a safe distance behind and then help only with the menial chore of driving the stolen longhorns to Yellow House Canyon on the high plains. There, the Comanchero traders of New Mexico waited to take them for guns and powder and flint and tobacco. After two of these dusty and uninspiring ventures, Eagle Feather had finally decided to take a chance on Gray Horse. A hardy veteran of many lucrative expeditions, Eagle Feather had led a party of 10 to see what booty they might find lying around in the western Texas settlements. He had traversed the country many times and knew its major landmarks. He knew where good horses were to be had, and he knew the rough country where trailing would be difficult even for the rangers. Late one night, in a show of daring, Eagle Feather had led the party into one of the villages. There, Gray Horse saw for the first time the peculiar stone and wooden houses of the Tejanos, cumbersome structures that a man could not pick up and move as the people could move their teepees. He wondered what the white men did when the rain failed and they needed to move with the grass.
What does the white man do with his women when the changing moon brings their bleeding days?
Among the people, a woman had to remove herself from her family during this period and stay alone where her sickness would not contaminate her man or his food or his medicine. For this purpose, Comanche women had teepees of their own in which they could wait out that annoying time, then bathe and cleanse themselves thoroughly before they rejoined the group to take up their normal routine. He saw no such separate places for the white women unless they be those tiny huts behind each large house. Perhaps those were large enough for white women, but Comanche women would have complained bitterly. Gray Horse crept up to the window of one building and stared in curiosity at men sitting beside tables, drinking what he surmised to be the make-crazy water he had heard about, playing some sort of game with little flat squares they held in their hands or laid down in a pile. Some seemed to be quarreling among themselves, but he could judge only by the tone, not the words. He marveled at their hairy faces, their hairy arms. They reminded him more of some strange animal than of men. They seemed, too, to be wearing a lot of clothes for the summertime. One of the warriors tapped him on the shoulder and beckoned him away from that curious place. He pointed to several horses tied to a rail in front of the building. Gray Horse moved in quietly, afoot, cut the reins, and led the horses away in a slow walk, making little sound on the soft, hoof-scuffed street. He noted that the horses bore leather saddles much different from the rawhide kind the people fashioned for themselves, and even different from those of the Mexican Comancheros. These appeared heavy and cumbersome, too much weight for a horse to carry under pursuit. He wondered if everything the white man owned was unnecessarily heavy as his houses and his saddles.
You move with padded feet, Gray Horse.
Gray Horse accepted the honor, but he knew where the power came from. He had been granted the silent cunning of the wolf.
Anyone can walk.
Resenting Grey Horse's accomplishment, Bear discovered horses in an adobe corral behind a house. The settler evidently was wise to the ways of the Indians, for the only gate was beside the house, near an open window where he could hear anyone moving it. But Bear that turns to fight had another strategy. He took a long rawhide string, tied a rock in one end, and quietly dropped it over the adobe wall on the side farthest from the house. With the rock acting as a counterweight, he began sawing through the mud blocks with the rawhide. A chunky warrior named Terrapin made a similar cut a double arm's span away. Grey Horse helped them remove the cut blocks, leaving an opening for the animals to come through. Eagle Feather went in after them, bringing them out quietly to join the others already captured. By daylight, the raiding party was 10 miles from the Tejano village with more than 100 horses and mules. Not a shot had been fired. The horses taken from the white settlements were turned out to graze under guard in a small valley where the grass was good. The first timers, including Grey Horse, were sent out in opposite directions in search of fresh meat, their obligation to the seasoned men.
At last.
Grey Horse had seen 2 white-tailed does at a distance. He had tied his pony in a thicket to keep it out of sight and started a slow, careful stalking on the downwind side, trying to get close enough to put an arrow into the fatter of the pair. He was at the edge of a small clump of scrub oaks, almost within range, when one doe suddenly lifted her head from her grazing, glanced at something on the upwind side, and bounded into the scrub timber. Then he saw the soldiers. He began crawling backward without raising his body. He kept his head up just enough to see over the grass, to keep his eyes on the oncoming riders and their large string of driven horses. To his relief, he saw they would miss the trees by a small margin. These, then, were what the experienced warriors had been calling buffalo soldiers. The darkness of their faces and the short, kinky hair that somehow brought to mind the top knot of the buffalo. He lay transfixed in wonder as these riders came ever closer to him, driving a large number of loose horses. The white-faced man he gave only a glance, but the black white men fascinated him. He found it difficult to believe the color was real. Perhaps it was painted on for some religious or military reason. Or perhaps these men had spent their lives in the sun and had been burned so dark that the color was taken for black. Beneath those blue clothes, he thought, their skin was probably white like that of the one man who rode to the side of the others, with them and yet not one of them. Eagle Feather had told Grey Horse that the soldiers were always to be watched and never to be attacked except when they could be taken by surprise. They had the disadvantage of being slow to get started, and unless they had the aid of good trackers such as the Tonkawa Scouts or the dark-skinned Seminoles, they were usually not hard to shake off of a trail. They were not implacable like Texas Rangers, men always angry and always ready to travel. Eagle Feather said that the Rangers were savages. His heart skipped as his eyes seemed to lock onto those of a black soldier. The man was staring straight at him. To his relief, the blue-clad soldier said nothing to the men around him, though for a long time he kept watching the place where Grey Horse lay. Grey Horse studied the face. It was beardless and smooth, but he could make no judgment about the soldier's age. The dark faces all looked the same, except for variations in beards and mustaches. The loose horses had numbered something short of 100, not as many as Eagle Feather had grazing about his camp on the river. Almost immediately, Grey Horse began plotting to get away with them, or at least a part of them. It came to him that these soldiers would soon reach the river, not far from the camp where the warriors were taking their rest. The soldiers were moving slowly, walking their horses. Once they were beyond sight of him, he could mount up, make a wide circle, and reach the river ahead of them. The plan was already forming in his mind, though he didn't know whether the others would accept it. It seemed logical that the soldiers would spread the horses up and down the river to drink. If 3 or 4 warriors made a feint on one side, they might draw most of the soldiers away in pursuit. The others could then sweep down from the opposite direction and run off part or all of the horse herd. Grey Horse rose and sprinted briskly to the thicket where he had left his pony. Cousin Bear would have to hold silent tonight. Gideon Ledbetter's heart was in his throat. He would almost bet old Colonel's $5 gold piece he had seen an Indian in the clumps of oaks. But he wiped his sweating hands on the blue legs of his uniform and said nothing. Various recruits had been seeing wild Indians ever since they had left New Orleans, and especially since they had ridden out of Fort Sill, Indian territory, on their way south to drop reinforcements and horses at the Texas forts. Last night, an excitable Mississippian named Cully, helping guard the picket line, had fired at what he thought was an Indian. This morning, the lieutenant had found a fresh bullet hole oozing sap from a live oak. Other troopers, including Jimbo, had rawhided the recruit unmercifully all day. Gideon did not intend to give a false alarm and be made a fool of, though hair tickled at the back of his neck. He was jumpy like most of the others who rode through this strange and formidable land for the first time. It was wild and beautiful and awesome, bigger than he had imagined the whole world to be. Uneasiness had gnawed at him since they had left the last of the old towns and entered the wilderness, proceeding westward on horseback across the Indian nations on their way to Fort Sill. That place, in the heart of the reservations, was headquarters for Colonel Benjamin H. Grierson and the Black 10th Cavalry. From there, just east of the Wichita Mountains and the land set aside for the wild tribes, the tall, scar-faced but basically gentle Grierson commanded detachments scattered more than 200 miles south, all the way to the confluence of the three Concho Rivers. Near Sill was headquarters of the Indian Agency, a tiny island in a hostile sea. Gideon had not yet recovered from the stifling dread of his first Indians on Beef Issue Day. He had sensed their hatred as they stared at the passing troops. In another time, another place, they would gladly have impaled him on a lance. These Indians were prisoners of war, even slaves in a sense. Having been a slave much of his life, he thought he should understand their feelings. But he had been unprepared for the hostility, the raw hate in dark and flinty eyes, the deep resentment at being reduced to dependence. They both fascinated and frightened him. Their seeming wildness a violent contrast to the well-ordered world of his own limited experience. They were like this land they lived in, alien to anything he had ever known or imagined. The immensity of this country, the almost incomprehensible distances, seemed overpowering to him, fearsome yet strangely exhilarating. Most days of his life he had not traveled more than a mile from Cabin Row. A 3-mile trip to town was an event that required preparation. Some days here they had ridden 10 or 12 times that, dropping off men at unfinished Fort Richardson on the banks of the Crooked Lost Creek, at primitive Fort Griffin, standing like a sentinel atop a flat hill above the Clear Fork of the Brazos. He had never been able to shake the sense of being watched by hidden, hostile eyes. Other recruits had the same obsession, for they talked about it. He had not spoken of this. He felt ashamed. He was both envious and resentful of Jimbo's calm, his ability to whistle obliviously when Gideon was sure they were about to be fallen upon and massacred by savage men in feathers and breech clouts. Gideon's uneasiness was deepened by a conviction that if they ever fell into a battle with the Indians, he would not even know enough about his weapon to defend himself. The Army had provided Spencer rifles in basic training, but only once had it issued ammunition for practice. The white officers explained that the service was short of funds. The recruits were encouraged to practice marksmanship all they wanted, but they had to do it with empty rifles. In training, Gideon had not been allowed a chance to fire more than a half dozen live rounds, and not one had struck the bullseye. 2 rounds had misfired. The cartridges were old, left over from the rebellion. Good enough for black recruits, he had heard one officer say. Couldn't hit anything anyway. They could buy ammunition for themselves, an officer had commented, if they felt they needed more practice. But Gideon had found that the recruiting captain had not told him everything. He had not mentioned that the Army was going to mark down almost $100 against him for his first issue of clothing. At $13 a month, it was going to take him a right smart while to have any money in the first place. On top of that, he had to pay the Army laundresses to do his washing. He had kept in mind what the captain had told him about being able to save his money and buy a farm. From what he had seen so far, he would have a long gray beard before he had $100. The recruiter had not lied about riding horseback and getting a lot of fresh air. Gideon's rump was toughening now, but at first he was rubbed so raw that the saddle was agony. He had slept few nights beneath a roof. One consolation helped make up for many disappointments. So far, they had not split him and Jimbo. Jimbo was Gideon's only remaining hold on the reality of the past. Jimbo and the $5 gold piece. The plantation, old Colonel, Aunt Ella, those seemed already unreal, obscured in the haze of memory by the harsh demands of this totally different life, this unimaginable land. Jimbo beside him, whistling a plantation work song, as unconcerned as if he were exercising one of old Colonel's horses on a nice flat road beside a cotton field in full blossom. He had taken easily to this army life. His handy way with horses had won favorable attention from officers wherever he had stayed long enough for them to observe him at his work. Gideon studied the young white officer who rode alongside the troopers, just distant enough to show he was in charge. Lieutenant Hollander was on his way back to Concho after leave to his old home in the east. He had been at the corrals the evening that Gideon and Jimbo and the others had arrived at Sill. Quickly discerning that Jimbo had more than average talent with horses, Hollander had seen to it that this talent was not displayed to the Sill officers. Being placed in charge of the recruits as they were scattered among the posts to the south, he had marked Jimbo down as his personal orderly.
Don't you be doing any showing off when we get to Concho, boy. If I can win some money on you before they catch on, I'll give you a cut.
Jimbo had seen no objection to that, but he had insisted that he and Gideon stay together. Hollander had been true to his word. Gideon had tried to figure out the lieutenant, comparing him to white folks back home. Hollander seemed troubled. At Fort Griffin, when the officers meant to take all the good horses for themselves, Hollander had come near blows with another lieutenant. Only a captain's intervention had prevented a fight. Naturally enough, the captain had sided with his own lieutenant in the division of mounts. Outranked, Hollander had gotten drunk that night. He and the Griffin lieutenant had settled their differences behind the stables in the moonlight. Hollander had won the fight, but not the war. He was still left with the Snide horses. Gideon overheard him as they left Griffin, heading out down the military road toward Concho.
It doesn't matter. The Indians will probably get them all anyway.
If the rest of the horses were as unmanageable as the brown Gideon was riding, the army at Fort Concho was in trouble, he thought. He was glad they moved mostly at a walk, for the brown trotted roughly enough to jar a man's innards loose. And it seemed to follow its own inclinations rather than those of its rider. He had what Jimbo called an iron jaw. He responded poorly to the bit. When Gideon tried to rein him to the right, the brown was as likely to go to the left out of pure contrariness. Gideon wondered if there might be a little mule blood in him. Hollander touched spurs to his dark sorrel horse and rode to the front of the detail.
That's the Colorado River down there. We'll water the horses and rest them a while. Keep your eyes open.
A chill came to Gideon's stomach as Hollander slipped his carbine from its scabbard and laid it across his lap.
Don't let those horses scatter too much on the river. Just give them room enough to drink.
He motioned for the men to spread out. Gideon's mouth was dry. Downstream, he watched ruefully as most of the horses waded right out into the water, roiled the mud, and deepened the red. He was thinking he was too late for a good clean drink.
Look there!
He glanced west first, toward the other soldiers and the horses. Most of the men were looking in his direction and beyond him, milling in excitement.
What?
Jerking his head around, he saw a stir of color and movement, horses running straight toward him.
Indians!
For a moment, he sat twisted in the saddle, numb. The breath stopped in his throat. He felt as much as heard an arrow whisper past him. The soldiers began firing. He realized he was in between them and the Indians, and most were no better marksmen than he was. He counted three Indians racing toward him. No, four, waving feathered shields, loosing arrows. Gideon managed to bring up his carbine and squeeze the trigger. The recoil slammed the butt hard against his shoulder, and through the puff of black smoke, he had no idea if he had hit anything. In a second, he took another count. All four were still coming. The firing behind him threw his horse into a panic. It ran away from the gunfire toward the Indians.
No! Stop!
Gideon hauled frantically on the reins, trying to stop him, to turn him, to do any damn thing. The horse kept running, carrying him headlong toward those four feathered, shouting, surprised Indians. Gideon's heart swelled to bursting. An insistent roaring in his head blocked out all other sound. His mouth was open and he was either shouting or screaming. He didn't know which. He raised the carbine and fired again. The Indians suddenly spread out, startled by the unexpected sight of a lone soldier charging directly into them. One held his ground. The next 2 or 3 seconds seemed to stretch into an hour. Gideon saw the young face painted in lightning streaks, the black eyes wide in exhilaration. He saw the stone-tipped war club in the warrior's outthrust hand. As he brought the Spencer up and sighted over the barrel, he saw the painted shield swing around, rimmed with feathers that seemed to fan out in the wind. It was painted black except for a jagged streak slashed across it, and for 4 red spots like animal tracks. Beneath it hung some sort of a brush. No, the tail of an animal. As Gideon squeezed the trigger, the shield dropped a little and he saw the face again. He saw the eyes, wild with excitement. The hammer fell silently. The cartridge failed. The 2 horsemen slammed together. Gideon grabbed at the saddle to keep from losing it and he dropped the carbine. He saw the war club streaking at him. Instinctively, he threw up his left arm to ward off the blow. He felt a crushing pain as the stone struck him and glanced away. He caught the triumph in the young Indian's eyes as momentum carried them past each other. He was already half out of the saddle, and he knew he was going down. He struck the ground rolling. Panic grabbed him at the thought of being helpless in the midst of the Indians. He jumped to his feet, bringing up in both hands a chunk of wood he had rolled across. He swung it back over his shoulder, ready to strike anything which came at him. The Indian could take him easily now if he turned and came back, but he did not. Through the dust and the shouting and the shooting and confusion, Gideon saw Jimbo racing toward him.
Swing up behind me!
Gideon grabbed his friend's arm. He swung up partway, though not enough to secure himself behind the saddle. It did not matter. Jimbo caught hold of him and spurred downriver out of the fray, giving Gideon a chance to pull himself into a better position. Gideon looked fearfully behind him, sure the Indians were upon them, but they were busy elsewhere. He and Jimbo were to themselves. Jimbo turned his horse and went back.
Better jump down and get that gun.
Gideon did, acting from impulse more than deliberation. One lucid thought managed to come through.
I hope the Indians got that brown horse.
The brown had swum the river and was climbing out on the other side. The Indians, so far as Gideon could tell, were all still north of the river. As suddenly as it had begun, the raid was over. The warriors were running their horses northward, yipping and yelling, driving a dozen or so head they had managed to cut from the bunch. They had missed the brown. The lieutenant loped out to Gideon and Jimbo. His voice was raw with excitement.
You boys all right?
Gideon couldn't bring out the words, but Jimbo had them.
Live and kicking, sir.
The lieutenant gave Gideon his full attention.
I'm damned if I can remember your name, soldier.
Gideon licked dry lips and managed to tell him.
Ledbetter. Gideon Ledbetter, sir.
Ledbetter? That was one of the boldest things I ever saw, the way you charged those Indians.
Words were slow to come.
It was the horse.
I don't know that your judgment is as sound as it should be, but nobody can fault you for nerve. I'll tell the commanding officer about you, Ledbetter. He likes to know who his soldiers are.
Gideon was beginning to feel sick from the aftershock.
The horse ran away.
The lieutenant missed his meaning. He saw the U.S.-branded horse on the other side of the river.
It's all right. We'll pick him up.
Feeling was coming back into Gideon's left arm. It ached as if it were broken. He gripped it with his right hand, giving in to the pain.
They wound you, soldier.
Gideon shook his head.
Just hit me with that club.
Hollander dismounted and felt the arm, watching Gideon for reactions.
Counted coup on you. Indians take a lot of stock in that. You've made some brave mighty happy.
Gideon's sleeve was torn. Blood began to stain the ragged edges. Incongruously, he found himself worrying about having to pay for another shirt.
Get that shirt off, soldier.
It hurt, but Gideon complied. The stone club's chiseled edge had bruised and gashed the flesh.
We better get those horses to the other side first, in case the Redskins decide to make another try. Then we'll catch the pack mule that carries the medical supplies. I'll patch you enough to hold you till we get to the post-surgeon.
Many of the recruits gathered around, staring at Gideon with surprise and admiration.
The Indians are going yonder way, sir, and taking some of our horses with them. Ain't we going after them?
The loss of horses shook him more than a fatality would have. Hollander looked at the dust left by the Comanches.
You boys showed grit, but you're still green. They'd just circle back on us and take more horses. Maybe all of them the next time. They might take a few of you, too. We'll leave well enough alone.
He turned again to Gideon.
The rest of them braced up when they saw what you did. I think they put up a better scrap than the Indians expected.
A half-grin tugged at the corners of his thin mustache.
You read the Bible much?
Gideon didn't want to admit that he couldn't read.
I know some about it.
There's a Gideon in the scriptures, you know. A soldier. They call him a mighty man of valor. But I'll leave the Bible to the chaplain. Charger, that's what I'm going to call you. Charger, for the way you charged into those Indians.
Hollander turned away to see about getting the horses across the river. Gideon stood clasping his left arm. A trickle of blood was warm and sticky between his fingers.
He wasn't even listening to me, Jimbo. I'd done my best to tell him the truth. That dumb horse just run away. I was scared flat to death.
Jimbo smiled.
Always tell white folks what they want to hear, and you'll never get no whip marks on your back.
The Colorado River and the skirmish lay far behind them as the rough hills and the red clay gave way to grass-blanketed flats and prairie dog towns sloping gently southward toward the Conchos. A movement to the left caught the eye of Frank Hollander.
Indians!
Hollander supposed the curved horns of an antelope might resemble Indian feathers to the uninitiated, still trembling in the aftermath of their first brush.
There is no recorded case of an antelope ever shooting a United States soldier. Jimbo, come forward with me.
The antelope, 12 or 15, broke into a run, paralleling the soldiers and the horses until they had moved well ahead. Then, in single file, they cut in front, white rumps flashing in the sun. Hollander pushed the sorrel into a lope. When he was within good range, he pulled his carbine from its scabbard, stepped quickly to the ground, and flipped the reins at the wide-eyed Jimbo. He dropped to his right knee, propped his left elbow on his left knee, and aimed, leading the last antelope to compensate for its fleet stride. The antelope tumbled, rolled once, and lay kicking. In fright at the shot, the horse jerked the reins from Jimbo's hand. Jimbo spurred to catch up, grabbing the reins and wrapping them around his wrist. Hollander held his breath because a man could get dragged that way. But Jimbo was strong and determined.
Whoa, easy, boy, easy. Come on now.
He brought the sorrel to a stop and led it back, talking gently and calming it down. Hollander smiled. He could not remember that he'd ever encountered a man who seemed to have such an easy way with horses. If he could keep the other officers from catching on too soon, he would get even for the shameless way they had collaborated to fleece him at poker and keep him near poverty. He rode to where the antelope lay, its open eyes dulling.
You know how to gut him, soldier?
I slaughtered many a hog.
Do it then, please. There'll be smiles in the officers' mess tonight.
In Hollander's opinion, compared to venison or even buffalo, antelope left something to be desired. But it was fresh and would help break the monotony for his fellow bachelors. The rest of the pronghorns were long gone across the flat. Unlike deer, they preferred the open where they could see an approaching predator and use their one defense, speed. They could outrun a horse, but not a bullet. Gideon Ledbetter rode up close as Jimbo remounted. Gideon held his bandaged arm tightly against his chest.
Hurtin' bad, Charger?
The recruit shook his head.
Ain't nothing much, sir.
The cloudy look in his eyes gave the lie to his words. Hollander suspected he was running a fever.
The fort's only a little further now. See where the big pecan trees line the river? Hold on a little longer.
The fort sprawled south of the river. Space seemed endless here, so the post had been spread liberally across a large block of land that the wise men of Washington had not seen fit to buy from the state of Texas. It had been so far from civilization that it seemed unlikely anyone would care to claim it. But some sharp Texas speculators had bought it after the army had put up several permanent structures. Now the government was paying a handsome yearly rent for the use of the ground. On the north bank clustered a motley assortment of raw picket shacks and Mexican-style jacales. San Angelo was a whiskey village subsisting entirely from the fort. Hollander compared it to a wood tick, which attached itself to a cow's ear and lived on blood. He made it a point to contribute as little as possible to the mud and stick village. More Fort Concho soldiers, black and white, had been killed or maimed in St. Angela than at Indian hands. Jimbo was showing a sharp interest and perhaps a warm anticipation.
I didn't expect to see no town way out here.
Hollander's eyes narrowed.
Well, it's hardly a town. More like a boil on a soldier's butt.
He led the troopers around the outer edge of the village to the shallow ford. A Mexican prostitute, dark of skin, waved from a rude jacal of pecan limbs, brush, and mud.
Hey, darling!
You'd better stick to army horses, Jimbo. These fillies have tricks you've never heard of.
A horror story the officers always recounted to new recruits was the experience of a white bugler in the fort's earliest days. He had been given a narcotic by one of St. Angela's soft doves so she could separate him from his money. After weeks near death, his body finally recovered, but his mind remained a shambles. The river ran deep in most places. Unwary soldiers who tried to sneak across in the dark of the night had been known to miss the fords and drown in the cold, treacherous waters. The men were especially vulnerable after partaking too long of cheap snakehead whiskey peddled for their pitifully few dollars. Up from the south bank loomed the sturdy stone corrals which Colonel William R. Shafter had built to protect post horses from thieves, red and white. Someone there had seen the recruits and the remounts coming, for a blue-clad trooper swung one of the wooden gates open, then stepped aside so he would not booger the horses away from the entrance. Hollander swung his arm.
Let's put them in.
Without being told, Jimbo loped ahead and took a position at the left to haze the horses through the opening. Hollander looked in vain for someone to do the same on the right without having to be told. He set his jaw grimly. A black soldier rode up and took the right-hand position. He sat straight in the saddle, his back rigid as a flagpole. Sergeant Esau Nettles bore himself like the commander-in-chief of all the armies. There was not another like him in the 10th Cavalry, and perhaps not in the entire service. Hollander had quietly laughed at him in the beginning, taking his manner for pretentiousness. He had not laughed in a long time. He had developed a disquieting feeling that had Esau Nettles been born white and in favorable economic circumstances, he might well have been the commander-in-chief of all the armies. Hollander watched until the bell mare trotted through the gate so he could be sure the rest would not spill and have to be chased down. Horses and men shared this lamentable trait at times. He rode up to Nettles, who sat on a big horse named Napoleon, black and shiny as a crow's wing. Nettles gave a sharp, self-consciously proper salute. Hollander's slack response would have earned him a demerit in the old days at the point.
Good to see you back, sir.
Hollander took that as a compliment. Rather than say what he did not mean, Nettles would have remained silent.
Good to see you're still here, Sergeant.
He studied the black face, trying to decide if a touch of levity was in order. With Nettles, he could never be sure. Nothing made the sergeant freeze up faster than the suspicion that a white officer was condescending to him. Hollander saw that Nettles' face bore the faint stirrings of a smile, an event worth noting in his diary, for that happened about as often as a good rain in this dry country.
I was afraid they might ship you off to another post while I was gone. I'd hate to break in a new top sergeant.
Nettles' smile was small and carefully rationed.
Well, I was afraid they'd keep you back east and I'd have to break in a new lieutenant, sir.
Hollander relaxed. He had caught Nettles on a good day, when none of the men in his charge had committed any serious breaches of good judgment or the Articles of War.
Who's the CO now?
Still Colonel Thomas, same as when you left, sir.
Fort Concho was notorious for frequent changes in command, even by the unstable standards of frontier posts in general. The post commander who oversaw the planting of a garden seldom stayed to enjoy all the season's produce. He watched the horses and the recruits enter the corral in a thick veil of gray dust.
Sergeant, I brought you some fresh meat.
You mean the men, sir? Or the horses?
Both. I know you'll be kind to the horses.
And the men. Chastisement is often a kindness, sir.
If that be the case, then the army has been kind to us all.
The sergeant's smile left him.
I see you come back all by yourself, sir. And I ain't counting the recruits.
Hollander looked away. He had expected questions from his fellow officers. He had not been prepared for them to start with the sergeant.
I am alone.
The sergeant nodded solemnly.
Yes, sir.
It was as far as he would pry into Hollander's privacy. The last of the horses trotted into the corral. Hollander waited for the dust to clear, then followed. Several black soldiers in canvas fatigue clothes had been cleaning corrals. They gathered to stare at the new recruits.
Post!
One fierce word from Sergeant Nettles scattered them like quail. The recruits sat on their mounts along the corral fence, some staring worriedly after the departing soldiers, wondering if they were right.
Sergeant, I turn these men over to you until they are signed. All but one. We had a brush with Comanches. I'm taking the wounded man to the post hospital.
I can take care of him, sir. Now, I expect you got other things to do.
This one's special, Sergeant. I want to be sure some hospital orderly doesn't slough him off.
Nettles said nothing, but Hollander read a critical thought in the half-closed eyes. The lieutenant had picked him a pet. There was, among some of the men, always an attempt to gain the favor of an officer so they might earn soft duty as orderlies or errand boys. Nettles had no more use for that kind than for the centipedes and scorpions which often infested the barracks' stone walls.
He showed conspicuous gallantry in battle.
Nettles had picked the slumped Gideon from the crowd.
He's quiet, sir, and he don't look like the type.
They seldom do.
Hollander asked Nettles to see that his antelope was delivered to the bachelor officer's mess, then beckoned for Gideon to follow. The other men watched him passively. Nettles pointed in the general direction of one on the end nearest the gate.
Damn you, soldier! Can't you see the lieutenant is fixing to pass? Open the gate for him!
In their haste to comply, two troopers bumped into each other. One went down.
Get up from there! Least you can do is act like soldiers instead of fools.
Hollander suppressed a smile that might compromise the sergeant's unbending discipline.
You men, line up your horses!
They were slow and sloppy about it. That situation would be corrected. The lieutenant skirted eastward around the storage buildings and the guardhouse. Just off the southeast corner of the parade ground stood the largest building in Fort Concho, the almost new hospital, with generous wooden porches all the way around, shading and cooling the native stone walls. The two-story middle section reminded him of a camel's hump. In its very center, rising to third-story level, was the glass-windowed Belvedere, standing like a tall sentry over the post. He tied his horse. Several black soldiers in gray canvas fatigues were raking and picking up litter. All snapped to attention and saluted, except one. He stood half a head taller than the others, a larger man than the army usually accepted for the cavalry. The army loaded the horses down with so much heavy equipment that the weight of the rider had to be limited. Making a show of his delay, the big man gradually brought himself to a reasonably straight stance and gave a belated and sluggish salute that carried more of defiance than of respect. Hollander smiled thinly, refusing the bait.
Well, Dempsey, I see they left the guardhouse door open again.
Dempsey made no reply, staring at him with thinly concealed resentment. Hollander's smile left.
The hell with it.
He saw Gideon making an effort to tie his horse.
Dempsey! Can't you see the man needs help?
Dempsey took one step forward and stopped.
He can do for himself.
Help him or I'll sic Nettles on you.
Hollander pushed the door open and automatically held it for Gideon before realizing that the soldiers outside were watching. It was not good form for an officer to be so solicitous of enlisted men, especially blacks.
The hell with that, too.
Post Surgeon Buchanan stood in the hallway, his white jacket rumpled but clean. His light-colored beard needed combing. By that, Hollander assumed the hospital was busy as usual. This country was hard on men who hadn't become acclimated to it. Few of the black troopers had been here long enough to have fallen into tune with its seasonal rhythms. Its summer heat and its deceptive winter cold, its spring dust and its autumn asthma. Buchanan stared in surprise.
Hollander, I hadn't heard that you'd gotten back.
Just rode in.
Buchanan smiled.
Well, where's the bride?
He looked at Gideon.
I know that's not her.
Hollander's jaw went tight.
There is no bride. What I've got here is a fierce Indian fighter, and he's taken a wound in the line of duty. I've come to see that he gets the best of attention.
Buchanan appraised Hollander and saw he was not making fun.
Well, I suppose some married junior officers on this post will be glad you didn't bring a wife with you. You'd have bumped half the families on officers' row. That's bad for their morale.
Would have been good for mine, though.
Until more permanent officers' quarters were completed, it was standard operating procedure for some or all of the bachelor officers to be billeted on the hospital's second floor. Hollander looked toward the stairway and cringed with dread at the thought of resuming residence up there amid the odor of disinfectants, listening to other officers complaining about the conduct of their foot-dragging troops, or recounting and grossly embellishing for the 20th time old tales of past conquests, military and female. He pointed his chin at Gideon.
I've still got a man standing here bleeding.
That was an exaggeration. The bleeding had long since stopped. Buchanan beckoned with his finger.
Follow me, soldier.
Gideon glanced quietly at Hollander for confirmation and then complied. Hollander trailed him to the examination room. When he saw that Buchanan meant to cut off Gideon's sleeve, he protested.
The army will make him pay for that blouse, like as not. Let's save it if you can.
He carefully helped Buchanan slip the sleeve off Gideon's stiffened arm. Gideon winced, but made no sound. The surgeon felt impassively around the wound, exerting no particular care to spare the soldier pain.
Arm's not broken.
His brow wrinkled.
That's not from a bullet, nor from an arrow.
One of those stone axes the Comanches used to scatter brains. This soldier charged in like he meant to wipe out the whole tribe.
It sounds to me as if they missed your brain by a long way. That's probably in your feet.
It was my horse.
Mark my words, Buchanan. This man will make corporal before his first year is out.
If he lives that long.
The surgeon began to wash the wound with something that smelled like bottled death and burned like unstoppered hell. Gideon clenched his strong white teeth to keep from crying aloud.
This wound won't kill you, soldier, but it'll probably weep for a few days.
When Buchanan was through and his routine paperwork given its customary lick and a promise, Hollander accompanied Gideon out the door. He spotted Big Dempsey giving the army nothing but his presence.
Dempsey! Come here!
The big man complied slowly enough to show his independence without culpable insubordination.
Take this man back to the corrals and turn him over to Nettles.
Dempsey's narrowed eyes said that Gideon could just as well find his own way back.
Yes, sir.
Hollander turned to Gideon.
Charger, you do what Sergeant Nettles tells you and you'll get along fine. Cross him, and you'll think you've crawled into a den with three grizzly bears.
Yes, sir.
He walked stiffly along the porch, his teeth set in what Hollander took to be pain. At the end of it, he turned.
Sir? It was the horse!
Hollander blinked in surprise and wondered whether Dempsey's manner was contagious. He attributed it to fever, gone to Gideon's head.